Possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Village in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including Pretty Nails, Milo's Restaurant, and McCandless Photography, located on the lower level, still using a traditional film process to create contemporary portraits.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back to the show Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor from Carl Clinic in Urbana. And every other month, he's here on the program to answer your healthcare questions. We have built this into the schedule so that you would have a regular opportunity to talk with someone who's a kind of a generalist, somebody who deals with both adults and children, and who has to try to help people who have all manner of health complaints. And so he's been very generous with his time and come over here every other month to talk with us. And we give you the opportunity to call in here and discuss your health concerns with him. Whenever we have a physician on the show, I always say right at the beginning, just so people understand that we cannot do diagnosis over the phone. There are limits to what we can do, but we do these shows to help add to your store of health knowledge, to give you a place to start. And if you have some concerns, do go ahead and pick up the telephone. And I know the doctor will do his best to see if we can help you out. 333-9455. That's the Champaign Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you can give us a call. Thanks very much for being here once again.
Thank you, David.
Just maybe I thought I might ask you a little bit about flu shots again here at the beginning, just because, well, first of all, people will obviously remember that earlier this fall we were talking about the fact that there is a shortage of vaccine, and that so everyone who would like to have a shot will not be able to have one. But we also said that we thought probably there would be enough vaccine so that the people who were in the high-risk categories could indeed have flu shot.
Correct.
Now I'm reading some stories that says here and there, there are places they actually have now have a surplus of vaccine. Whether it is that people tried to get a shot and couldn't and got discouraged, whether the fact that there hasn't really been big problem with flu yet means people are saying, no problem, or people heard there was a shortage, so they didn't even try. I don't know. I guess I'm curious about in, say in Champaign-Urbana, have you at your place given out all the vaccine that you've got, or do you still have vaccine on hand?
We actually have just a few doses left and are still trying to encourage individuals who have high risk categories in terms of their own illness to come in and get a flu shot. In general, it would be nice if everybody who wanted one could get one, and that's still not the case. But there should be an adequate supply to vaccinate high-risk patients. And if those individuals were indeed discouraged by the long lines or the stories early on, it's still worthwhile checking either with their own personal physician or the health department to see if vaccine is available in their area. There has been some problems with certain areas having not enough and other areas then turning out to have more than they need, and it's a matter of getting it into the right place.
So again, review for us the people who are considered to be high risk. Who do you recommend should get a shot?
Basically, all of those individuals over the age of 65. By virtue of their age, are considered high risk. And then any other individuals who have significant cardiopulmonary disease processes would also be considered high risk.
All right. We have some calls. Let's go to the phones. And we'll start with someone in Terre Haute, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
I have a heart condition. I think it's atrial fibrillation.
Fibrillation.
And, my doctor told me that I could have a procedure called ablation, I believe it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so they scheduled a surgery, and then they called me back up and said, no, you're not a candidate for it, without an explanation. I don't know if you can help me or not.
Well, with the information that you've given me so far, I'm not sure I can answer your specific question as to why you weren't considered a candidate. As a general rule, atrial fibrillation is an irregular heart rhythm that can produce symptoms in individuals ranging from chest pain and shortness of breath and dizzy spells. But the major medical concern about atrial fibrillation is that it increases the risk for stroke in those individuals. As a general rule, you either control the heart rate or the heart rhythm or both. And in many instances, individuals whose rhythm can't be converted back to normal are put on long-term blood thinners to reduce their risk for stroke. There are some patients whose abnormality can be electrically converted by basically operating on the electrical system of the heart. The ablation procedure that you were potentially scheduled for is a procedure whereby a portion of the heart that's identified as producing an abnormal electrical signal that stimulates the atrial fibrillation is then electrically destroyed so that that signal can't start up and produce this abnormal rhythm. The real specifics of whether you are or aren't a candidate for this particular procedure would be determined by your cardiologist.
Okay. I exercise a lot, and when it goes out of rhythm, normally I can exercise and get it back into rhythm. And they tell me not to be concerned about it, and I'm not necessarily concerned. Are there medications that that would work?
There are medications that can control the heart rate. Basically, with atrial fibrillation, if the rate's not controlled, the heart rate can achieve very, very rapid rates in the 150 or better range.
Mine doesn't do that. Mine just is irregular.
Right.
It doesn't go fast. It just is irregular.
Right. And there are medications to regulate the rate. There are other medications that can be used to try and convert the heart rhythm from the abnormal rhythm back into the normal rhythm. Depending on why you have the atrial fibrillation, they may or may not work.
I'm sorry, what?
Depending on why you have your atrial fibrillation, medications to try and convert your heart rhythm may or may not work. Okay. If you have an underlying electrical abnormality that can't be suppressed with medication, then the electrical ablation procedure is the next step.
There's a procedure I've heard of also where they go in and actually open the chest up and scar the heart.
That's not commonly used for this particular condition.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. Let's go next to someone in Chicago. Line one. Yes.
When you talk about nothing new under the sun, along comes the information that researchers point out the benefits of cinnamon in helping those who have a diabetic or a particular sugar problem. I was wondering if you'd heard anything about it, because there's been quite a bit of literature on the benefits of it, and some health food products are now advocating the use of cinnamon for that purpose. Do you know anything more that you may have heard of?
I'm sorry, this is the first I've heard of it, and I'm afraid I don't know anything about the potential health benefits of that.
Okay, then. Well, I just thought I'd call in, because there's significant literature about the research being done on it and advocating its use, and some products are now going full force ahead with the promotion for diabetic and sugar conditions. Thank you.
All right. Let's go to Indiana. This is the next caller. It's line number two. Hello.
Hello. If you can, I'd like for you to give some information or criticism or however you want to put it about these mobile units that show up in your town, and for $185 or whatever, they'll check everything under the sun with you. And I heard a program, I think it was on Dave's watch, but anyway, that they were talking about that the thing they did with the heart and arteries was since more or less piecemeal, and that you needed more information before you made any decisions from these kinds of tests. And if you could you enlighten us on some of this stuff?
Well, you may be talking about a couple of different mobile units that are making the rounds. There are mobile CT scanners that are doing whole body CT scans, and there are also mobile scanners that are using basically sonogram type machines to do vascular screening of carotid arteries, femoral arteries. And the major problem with these is that they do the test, give the result to the individual who paid cash for them, and really they don't provide any interpretation. In many instances, I've had folks come to the office and say, oh, here's my test result, and it looks abnormal. And you go through the history and the physical exam, and there's nothing there. And now we've raised this question in their mind that there's something bad, and we end up doing multiple other tests to try and prove that, they really don't have a problem. A general rule in medicine is that you don't order a test unless there's a good reason to do so, because you're going to make a decision to do or not do something based on the results of the test. So in situations where people are simply randomly having tests with no underlying reason for it, it's not terribly surprising that what we would consider to be incidental findings, basically normal variations in lots of people, show up on a variety of tests, but they may or may not have any real medical significance. And so for the kind of money that they charge, I personally think it's probably better spent with a visit with your own personal physician to say, based on my history and my physical exam, what am I at risk for? What should I be paying attention to? What sort of things should I be screened for, rather than just saying, well, I'm going to go get my whole body scanned by a CT scan and we'll see what comes up.
I guess that what that gets at is the fear that perhaps some people have that they may have some sort of serious condition and have no symptoms. They're afraid that there's something going on and that one day it's just going to go like that, and that they would have had no warning about that.
And in fact, that will be true for some individuals. Mm-hmm. And the question that becomes then is, okay, everybody gets a whole body CT scan. Well, do I repeat it next week, next month, next year? When is this sudden asymptomatic fatal illness going to occur?
But the question is that suppose you do that. So how many undetected illnesses are going to pick up, and how many of the scans are going to show nothing in particular?
In actuality, that's actually been looked at, and there what the medical literature refers to as incidentalomas. is the term that's been used, which basically says that if you scanned everybody's inside, you'd find all sorts of interesting oddities that probably don't really have any significant medical importance, but they're not, quote, normal. Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, normal is a wide degree of variability in the human condition, and in fact, they probably are, quote, normal for that individual, don't represent disease. But now that you've identified that there's this little cyst here or this little bump there, you know, what are we going to do about it besides worry? You know, if the follow-up test is a biopsy, now we're starting to potentially harm individuals checking out things that they didn't have any symptoms related to anyway. But, you know, your original point was that, yes, if you did, you know, 10,000 chest x-rays on perfectly asymptomatic individuals, you are going to find a few lung cancers that people didn't know that they had. The question becomes, is it reasonable then to subject 10,000s, if not hundreds and or millions of people, to chest x-rays in hopes of finding a couple of people who have currently asymptomatic lung cancers? Mm-hmm. The overwhelming medical evidence says, no, it's not a reasonable thing to do to expose that many other individuals to ongoing radiation in hopes of just by chance finding something in somebody who doesn't yet have a symptom. And that's simply the limitations of where we are in terms of medical diagnosis right now.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carr Clinic. And on this program every other month, it's always on a Monday at 11 o'clock hour. And this is what we call our Talk to the Family Doctor show. If you have questions, you can call 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Next is a listener in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Always grateful when Dr. Schweringer is on the show. I have a question about an elderly male relative who has been forced to have a catheter for the last maybe 9 months because the bladder does not contract. And I wondered, and he has seen a urologist and they've done the test and it just doesn't contract. And I wondered if there are any options that are open to somebody with this kind of condition. I know that for people who have incontinence, for women, there are these Kegel exercises, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, to help tighten the floor of the pelvis. Is there anything like that for males? Or I wondered about, I had heard that there was electrical stimulation of nerves and muscles to help them function better, and I wonder if any of that would be practical for somebody who has, a male who has a bladder that does not contract.
Was it identified as to why it didn't contract?
No, there was no identification. They just said it doesn't contract. Now, originally, when they used the catheter, they thought that it just wasn't emptying properly, and that. But then they did one of the tests, and it was determined that it's not contracting.
Okay. Are there other underlying medical conditions that this individual has?
No, and they also said that the prostate, removing parts of the prostate would not solve the problem, and that it just appeared that the individual would just need to have a catheter for the rest of their life. Are there other tests to discover why it is not contracting?
Potentially, yes. The most common test that most urologists do in situations like this are called urodynamic testing. But in some instances, especially in a situation like what you've described here, a neurologist may be of benefit as well. There are sometimes problems related to the spinal cord and the nerve supply from the spinal cord to the bladder that can sometimes be a cause for the kind of problem that you've described here. And so if basic urological tests haven't been terribly helpful, it may be quite worthwhile to pursue a neurological evaluation to see if there's perhaps an answer there.
Thank you very much. I certainly will pursue that.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for the call. And again, we'll go on to another listener. This person is in Chicago on our line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Before I make my comment, I just wanted to say that the gentleman who was asking about cinnamon for diabetes, that's only for type 2 diabetes that they found it to be effective. And he probably needs to go on the Internet to get some of the research. The early research was done in Canada, but they seem to be doing research now. And there's even supplements in the health food store where the cinnamon's prepared in a water extract that they can take. So he can get more information about that, but it's only for people with type 2 diabetes. I think that it's proven effective. But my question is about something that's really disturbing me. I was told by a doctor that a particular medicine was very effective with African Americans, and when I asked him what set of genes had been identified as specific to African Americans that the drug worked with, he didn't have an answer. And I talked with some other friends, and I was told that there's a promotion of certain drugs as being good for African Americans, And I'm just wondering what's going on.
Can you specifically identify which medication you're referring to?
The one that I know about specifically is Lotrel. Someone else told me that there was a medicine for diabetes that he had been told was good for African Americans. But in this case, this was Lotrel. And as I said, when I asked what set of genes has been identified as African American that this medication is supposed to work with so spectacularly, the doctor couldn't tell me. And so I'm just wondering, is this, I guess I'm very suspicious because the medical profession has a real bad history with experimentation on African Americans and minority groups. And I'm just wondering why all of a sudden do we have medicine being identified, especially at this time when there's pretty much no cellular, on the cell level, no basis for using those terms. What's going on, I guess, is my question.
Well, you're correct. I don't believe that there's any significant genetic difference in humans to account for changes in response to medication. What we do have in some instances is essentially just statistical data that when certain medications are used in studies, usually for the efficacy of the medication, they simply keep track of all the variables that are, you know, the patient's age, patient's gender, patient's socioeconomic status, race, geographic location, and basically just look for any type of association that says in a particular subset of patients, does this particular medication offer any specific advantages or disadvantages? Some medications have been basically marketed, I think, as being more effective in certain populations. But
the question would be why, because there's no science to that at all.
Certainly no proof other than the statistical associations of subgroup populations and data done on the medication. But you're correct, there isn't any.
There's no science.
There's no proof that that's the case.
Well, why would a doctor who, I guess I don't understand. I can see why the pharmaceutical representatives would push it, but I don't see why a doctor who has been trained in science would accept it and even sprout that sort of nonsense to patients.
Now, that's something you'll have to address to him.
I guess so, but I am rather concerned, and I've heard it more than once, and I've heard people talking about it, and I just would really like to know why in this day and age would even the pharmaceutical company want to use that.
Well, I can answer the pharmaceutical question because anything that they can identify that they think will separate their product from some other product it simply becomes a marketing tool.
But you can't explain why someone trained in science would accept it.
I can barely explain what I believe, let alone what somebody else does.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Let's go on here. And I think that next talk with somebody on line number two. The caller here, I believe, is in Danville. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
My question is, what age group is it recommended for vaccination for pneumococcus?
The standard recommendation is for all individuals over the age of 65 to receive the Pneumovax once. We do occasionally use it in susceptible individuals under that age, but it is a standard recommendation that everyone over the age of 65 be vaccinated against pneumococcal infections.
But just once,
not just once.
Every 5 years or anything?
No.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. And this is here, you're talking about this is for pneumonia.
It's for right. Pneumococcal pneumonia. When people say, I got the pneumonia shot, they're sometimes quite disappointed to come in a year later with some other type of pneumonia. Pneumococcal pneumonia is probably the most life-threatening form of bacterial pneumonias. But in fact, there are other kinds of bacterial pneumonias. There are viral pneumonias. There are a variety of other respiratory illnesses that an individual can come down with, even if they've been vaccinated against pneumococcal pneumonia.
Okay. So just this one, but it is, again, for people over 65. And it's a one-time, we think that grants lifelong immunity?
The current recommendations is once over the age of 65. If somebody received it prior to that age, they would get it again after the age of 65.
Right. Is there any reason for someone to have it who's younger than 65?
Individuals who perhaps have recovered from a bad pneumonia, somebody who has bad underlying respiratory disease where you're basically going to try and protect them against any kind of possible respiratory infection, the same people who would probably be candidates for an influenza vaccination would probably also be candidates for the pneumococcal vaccine.
Okay. The next caller is on line 3, and they are in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. With regard to 2 callers ago, I was paying attention to a news release, and that was either in our local paper from a national press report, or it was in Consumer Reports within the past month or two. There's been a lot of concern about heart failure, and there was a big report in Consumer Reports, I'm pretty sure, about heart failure being misdiagnosed or not recognized. And I have a friend who just died this year at the age of 62. She's black and died of heart failure, and I don't think she realized that she had heart failure. None of us expected this to happen. It happened pretty suddenly, although clearly it was something that was going on for a while. So I was paying attention when I saw an article in the newspaper or Consumer Reports about a study that had been done that found that a combination of 2 drugs worked better for heart failure in African Americans at preventing it from progressing. It's a progressive condition, as I understand it. I would suggest to the caller that if she wants to know more, that it's probably out there, you know, on the web. She might be able to find reference to these recent things. And I don't. My training is in biology some time ago. My understanding about studies is that you can do clinical studies where you see that you've got a problem and you go looking for what can we do about it. And then there's basic science, which is on a level of looking for genes. And you don't have to know whether there are genes that are causing this or why this is happening. If you see clinically that it's happening and you're looking for how do I save this patient now as opposed to how do I figure out why this is happening? It was a long time before we understood, if we even do now, why aspirin works, but we found that it worked. And my understanding about a lot of medicine is that we discover that something works a long time before we understand why it works. I understand her concerns, but I also would think that, particularly with diseases that are killing people, that we need to find ways to stop the killing, and then figure out why. So that's just some thoughts about where to look for more information so that she has a sense of whether it's legitimate or not. But it seemed legitimate to me, and so I would suggest some further looking for her.
Well, I'm going to try and tie your call and her call together a little bit. The congestive heart failure is an end-stage condition due to other medical problems. In the United States, the most common reason for somebody to develop congestive heart failure is poorly controlled hypertension. Now, on a population basis, we know that African Americans have a high incidence of hypertension. If it's poorly controlled, not treated well, they're going to have a high incidence of congestive heart failure. And the best treatment for congestive heart failure, as with many things in medicine, is prevention. But that starts years and years earlier. What people sort of fail to realize is that when you have congestive heart failure, you now have a condition that has a 5-year mortality of 50%. That's higher than most cancers. And people don't truly appreciate the seriousness of a diagnosis of congestive heart failure. This is an indication that the heart as an organ is reaching the last stages of its effective functioning. And what we're doing with medications, multiple medications, even surgical interventions these days, is simply trying to support adequate functioning of the heart as a pump so that it can contribute to normal circulation, so that you can oxygenate the rest of your organs. But you're really dealing with an end-stage condition at this point. And since hypertension is the most common cause for this, truly what really needs to be focused on is identifying individuals at risk for high blood pressure and then treating that aggressively. And more data is coming available that basically shows that what was considered an acceptable upper limit of normal kind of blood pressure in the past is in fact still too high. And that's where you're seeing new recommendations now that say, you know, really, your blood pressure shouldn't be more than 130 over 80. Used to be sort of 140 over 90 was acceptable. Now, whether certain medications work better for certain individuals or certain ethnic groups, you know, that remains to be determined. But each individual needs to do for themselves what it takes to get, in this case, their blood pressure under control. And that's really what will make a difference in the long run.
Well, and a lot of that has to do with the kinds of foods that we grow up eating and think of as comfort foods and good foods. And
well, certainly the salt content of the American diet is way out of line. And there is a definite physiological basis associated between the salt content of our diet and our blood pressure. And the average American diet has about 10 times the amount of sodium in it than the body actually needs to function normally. And that's even before you pick up the salt shaker. So there are innumerable things that affect your blood pressure besides your genetic inheritance, certainly your lifestyle in terms of diet, exercise, weight, tobacco, alcohol use all have some potential effect on blood pressure. And these are all things that can be modified without resorting to medication.
But another comment I'd like to make about evaluating reports of studies is that in science, you often get a preliminary finding that says, oh, we've got a question here, and then a little piece of the puzzle falls into place.
It raises more questions that you then have to try and answer.
Right, and sometimes the preliminary study isn't big enough, and the question that the conclusion is can't be supported when you do it on a bigger study. So I think that it gets confusing, and I understand the previous caller's concerns because there was experimentation in African Americans, but at the same time we need to evaluate the new stuff coming out and saying an understanding that the science is hopefully a progressive thing and it's complicated. But I don't, from what I was reading about the two drugs that seemed to be more effective for African-American heart failure patients was that there was clinical indication that this was so, and it wasn't necessarily a drug company. But the drug companies, as we know, manipulate things, so it's worth looking into some more.
Right.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician from Carl Clinic in Urbana, and he is here on this program every other month on a Monday in the 11 o'clock hour for this show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. Here the idea is that if you have healthcare questions, you should feel free to call in, and I know he'll do his best to give you an answer. We are into our last 20 minutes. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The next caller up is in Urbana, line one.
This is such a worthwhile project. This program, this speaker, the opportunity for people to call in. I am always impressed at what we can learn. I was listening because I wanted to make a reaction to now the third person who called in, three back. But I learned about congestive heart failure, which my mother died of. And it was right on the button, and I'd never read anything about it. So, you know, I learned while I was waiting to call in. It's just a wonderful opportunity. I was calling because of the woman who was in anguish because of or was concerned about having medications for African Americans. And the last caller did a marvelous job of explaining the differences in research and what one can get from the research. And it makes me wonder, maybe there needs to be a program that you would have and a speaker or more to talk about different kinds of research and how one knows what one can learn from research, because the last speaker was just, or the last caller, was just very well attuned and very well, she understood some differences in what one can do. What I was naively going to say after I heard the caller who was concerned about the medications for Afro-Americans is that you don't have to know the theory in order to find that there are combinations of symptoms, conditions, whatever, that are ameliorated by certain medications. And as the last caller said so much better than I can, you don't need to wait until the theory comes around. It's a statistical relationship, and it's not that any company is trying to do anything devious, and as the last caller also said, it's not necessarily the pharmaceuticals who are doing the research. But you can get all kinds of information from research, and it does give indications. So if someone has a condition and something works statistically and you don't know, the doctor doesn't know what to do, that might be helpful. And so I think if that original caller were to think about that, then perhaps she would see it isn't a 1-2-3 relationship between, well, what's causing this and what to use, but you can just bop in there and in the middle and say what works statistically with the group that has been chosen and go from there. And as the doctor said, then do more research to follow up. So it isn't always someone being devious to get something proved. It's information that emerges. And it's a wonderful system. But I do think that there's a lot of there's a lack of understanding about research and how it needs to be set up and what we can learn from it. And I think the general public could really get some good help from a program from someone who knows about this, giving us guidelines for reading research as we do in newspapers and magazines. And that's all I have to say. And I just thank you for this program. It's so interesting this morning.
Very good. Well,
thank you.
Thanks for the call. Anything else you want to say about that?
Well, I think the caller has a very good point, because even within the medical profession, even within the basic science research community, there are tremendous debates over the validity of research. And tremendous debates over the accuracy of the conclusions drawn from research. People sometimes mistakenly think that, you know, in the lab something's proven. Well, in fact, you know, it's rarely black and white. And there is as much uncertainty about research as there is in every other aspect of life. You try, in terms of research, to have a particular study replicated someplace else. The more times that something can be replicated and people get the same kind of results, the more likely it is to probably be true. Small studies may not turn out to be valid when you apply it to a larger population, as our previous caller mentioned. Part of the difficulty that I think we have today is that in many instances, things get published on the front page of the newspaper before they've actually even made it into the original journal that it's being published in. It's actually released to the public before anybody's had a chance to even read the article. And then, you know, it makes a big splash because, you know, somebody excerpted part of the article and put it on the front page, and it generates a lot of publicity, which is fine, but it doesn't necessarily mean just because it's printed in the newspaper that it's true. And it certainly doesn't mean that it's applicable to everybody. So I think the last caller's point about having people generally become more educated on how to interpret research is an excellent one. It's not necessarily an easy subject because, as I said, it's a matter of debate within the medical and scientific community all the time. And it would really, I think, increase the public's awareness if somebody could explain sort of how research is done and how conclusions are drawn. It would be, I think, really a very good public service.
Well, we have a number of other callers, so we'll try to get them all in the time that remains. Excuse me. We'll go next to a caller in southern LaSalle County. That's on our line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm making a racial comment that has nothing to do with my comment. I was telling a friend that I could smell smoke on his breath a couple of weeks ago, that I just heard that smoking was harder on black men than it was on white men. So if you might make a comment on that. But my question is, knowing about, well, not knowing really the name, and I'm forgetting it all the time, but having peripheral neuropathy, not connected with diabetes. I was sort of clued in on this maybe about 2 years before it happened, so somebody that might be having the same thing might get a little more out of it. But when it started to happen to me, I wondered if it was going to proceed quickly from my toes to my neck and strangle me to death. And anything you could tell me about the disease, the last time I called a doctor on this program, I believe she said, well, I know it's to do with your spinal cord, but she said something about it was like the closer to the surface nerve stuff, I think I got her, what the peripheral meant. But let's see, the other thing I wanted to ask. Oh, and then I asked a friend that had a computer, and she says there was nothing on it. And when I bought a piece of paperback nurse's stuff, I found out how to spell it. That's about it. So anything you could tell me would be appreciated. Is it a long-term disease, or is it something that's going to get you quick, or what?
I'll try my best here. The term peripheral neuropathy is a pretty general one.
Oh, really?
And not necessarily a specific diagnosis.
Mm.
You alluded to the fact that it's not associated with diabetes.
Right. It could have been worse if it was diabetes.
Right.
Diabetic.
But in fact, most peripheral neuropathies are a problem whereby the nerves typically going out to the extremities, your arms and hands, your legs and feet, are affected. That generally then produces either numbness or tingling or weakness. Sometimes a sort of a painful electrical kinds of sensation can sometimes occur with these. But it's usually a result of some other medical process that's causing damage to the nerve.
Oh, really?
And so the
I think somewhere or heard somewhere that maybe nutrition had something to do with it.
Well, in some instances, certain types of deficiencies like B12 and folate can be associated with this. And usually the investigation is trying to identify what underlying medical condition is causing the damage to the nerve.
Well, I've been trying to get somebody to take me up to Mayo's, but being I can't drive, I haven't had any results so far.
Okay.
I'm going to offer them food and money both. Anyway, I wanted to ask you one other thing. Boarding my dogs, the man out there happened to say that, oh, I was in a walker for like 5 years or something, and he had some of this, his own stem cell stuff done, and I forgot to ask him where. And now he's all right, but of course he didn't have my ailments, so I wondered about that.
I'm not sure I know exactly what your question is.
Would anything to do with stem cells help at all?
Until you can identify the underlying cause for your problem, I'm not sure I can answer that.
I see. I really appreciate everything you had to say, and I'm still going to try to go to Mayo's, which I'm very familiar with, and my own doctor said keep in touch.
And we'll wish you good luck as well.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Let's go next to another caller, and this listener is in Ashmore, line number 2. Hello.
Yes, hello. Mm-hmm. I have a question, not a dissertation. Okay, and my question is, you're reading now about vitamin E, both the alpha and the gamma, and there's some medical history coming from the various media that excesses in 400 units of international vitamin E, alpha is, you shouldn't take it every day.
I have heard that as well. The trouble that we've had in the past with studies related to vitamin E is that they haven't always defined specifically which form of vitamin E that they were using. So it's very hard to look at some of the older studies and know whether it was sort of good or bad for you. Currently, there are concerns that higher doses of vitamin E may potentially interfere with some of the newer medications for cholesterol control. And I think going forward, they will need to be a little bit more specific about what exact form of vitamin E that they're using and what they're sort of testing it for before we can draw conclusions as to whether it's going to be helpful or not.
What do you recommend?
In the absence of a specific condition, other than the vitamins found in a good general multiple vitamin, which assures that you get the, you know, the basic recommended daily allotment of the normal vitamins, I don't necessarily recommend that people take any additional vitamin E.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. To Champagne, line 3. Hello. So call it there, line number 3.
Hi.
Yes.
I am having some problems with sleep. It's actually a long-term problem. What happens is I tend to get very tired at night, and then I wake up, you know, at some point during the night, and my heartbeat seems to increase very rapidly, and then I cannot get back to sleep for like an hour or two. And I also feel very tired and fatigued during the day.
You're not awakening, feeling particularly refreshed?
I do not, and I also I find myself feeling tired at various points during the day as well.
Do you have a bed partner who can comment on what goes on when you're sleeping at night?
No, unfortunately not.
In many instances, there are a variety of different kinds of sleep disorders that if they significantly compromise the quality or quantity of sleep that you get at night will certainly leave you feeling unrefreshed and therefore tired during the rest of the day. The usual way in which these are pursued is with a formal sleep study whereby a physician will monitor both your heart rate, your breathing, your oxygen levels during the course of sleep in a sleep lab. This can often identify whether there's a primary sleep disorder. Usually before we get to that stage, though, a general history and physical examination is done to make sure that somebody just isn't anemic or that their thyroid isn't underactive and that there's some other reason why that they might be, you know, tired. So ideally, starting with your personal physician for a general physical exam, if that's really unrevealing, then a formal sleep study might be helpful.
Well, actually, my personal physician did refer me for a sleep study. Unfortunately, I called Carl, and they can only see me at the sleep center there in mid-February. So you wouldn't happen to know of any other resources in the area where I could get a sleep study done?
I'm afraid I don't.
Uh-huh. And just on the basis of the symptoms with me waking up and my heartbeat increasing, would you be able to make any sort of diagnosis on that, on the basis of that?
Not with just that information, no.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right, thanks. Well, we want to try to get, we have our Chicago caller back with us real quick. We can try to get in her in again before we run out of time. Line number four, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I appreciate that these people think that nothing is untoward, but I think it's really clear that even clinical studies have to be based on scientific deduction. And if you say something is based on race and you know that race doesn't exist, then that should be the beginning of a question, not the end. And as you said, if congestive heart failure is a long process, you need to be looking at what does, quote-unquote, African-American or black represent in this case. And it might represent poor health care because the person is on public aid. And we know that there's a two-tier health system and that people on public aid are not getting the top-notch health care. And so that doesn't mean that you give them a special drug. It might mean that we try to equalize health care delivery.
I think that's an excellent point.
That's all I had to say.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much. We are at the point pretty much where we're going to have to stop for this time around. Any last thing you'd like to leave folks with?
I would just personally like to thank the listeners for their enthusiasm today. I thought we had some excellent callers.
Very good. Well, our guest here, Dr. Jeff Swearingen, is a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. He is here every other month to do the show, Talk to the Family Doctor. So I guess we will see, should see you in February, right?
I'll try and make it.
Very good. Thank you
very much.
The broadcast today is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, featuring foods from around the world, including imported chocolates, cookies, cheeses, and gift baskets for the holidays. Party catering also available. World Harvest Foods, located at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign. The broadcast also made possible by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering a wide selection of guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of every size and color combination, from new to antique, to complement any decor. Eastern Rug Gallery, 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign. Tomorrow morning on this program, Sandy Mason will be here. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. She's been doing programs with us for quite a long time where she would stop by during the growing season. We did them in the spring and summer and into the fall. And for all low these many years, she has always said, you know, if you'd like to do it year-round, I would do it. Well, this year we decided, yes, we want to keep Sandy coming back here. So this is our first time we'll be doing the show with her in December. So questions are welcome on things that grow in the home landscape, house plants too. Then in the second part of the program, we'll be talking with Charles Coulomb. He's a writer, and his recent book is titled Rum, The Epic Story of the Drink That Conquered the World. So shiver your timbers and tune in tomorrow morning in the 11 o'clock hour. We are here weekday mornings from 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions and comments. Right now, we hope you will stay tuned. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Yo-ho-ho, David. Good morning. And coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we will talk about the wit and wisdom of America's great comedy teams. Our guest will be Lawrence Epstein, professor of English. His latest book is Mixed Nuts, America's Love Affair with Comedy Teams, from Burns and Allen to Belushi and Aykroyd. That's in the 1 o'clock hour today of the Afternoon Magazine. On the Chicago Board of Trade now, December wheat is trading at 289, up 5. March, 301.5, up 5. December corn, 1.